Hey, Vashon, I wanted to share an incredible opportunity to listen on October 29th to award-winning filmmaker and documentarian Phil Grabsky, who will be speaking at the Vashon Theater and screening two of his films. Phil is a BAFTA, British Documentary Award-winning filmmaker, who has won multiple awards for his directing, writing, producing, and cinematography. His film, My Childhood, My Country, 20 Years in Afghanistan, which will be shown at the Vashon Theater, won more than a dozen awards, including Best Single Documentary at the 2022 British BAFTAs. Phil has made over 250 films, which have played in cinemas and on TV and digital platforms worldwide. To me, that number is staggering. His work ranges from social documentaries to histories, films on art and music, to a special series called Exhibition on Screen. Exhibition on Screen, that we'll talk about in my second interview, gives viewers an inside track on the art featured at major museum exhibits and at the same time teaches us more about the artists represented, who've ranged from Leonardo da Vinci to Marie Cassatt, to Frida Kahlo, to David Hockney, and many more. His film about the National Gallery in London will also be screened at the Vashon Theatre on October 29th. Welcome to Embracing the Muse. I'm your host, Sally Jean Fox, the author of Meeting the Muse After Midlife. And I'm on a quest to discover and understand how we can live our richest, most meaningful, and creative lives at any age, and especially as we age. Phil and I start our conversation talking about one of the two films to be shown at the Vashon Theater on October 29th. It's called My Childhood, My Country, 20 Years in Afghanistan. It starts out with a young 8-year-old refugee boy named Mir found in a cave in Afghanistan and follows him over the next 20 years. It's an extraordinary view into life in Afghanistan. It's won the prestigious British BAFTA Award for Best Documentary and has been shown around the world. Sadly, though, Phil's found very little interest in the United States. It's almost as if after we spent over $1 trillion and lost over 3,000 lives in Afghanistan, this country has moved on. We talk about the state of the documentary film industry, how hard it can be to finance a film, particularly like the one he'd like to do about the state of women in Afghanistan. And we discuss whether a filmmaker can ever be truly objective and how difficult it can be to know that your subject, who is very much alive, is also very vulnerable.
Essentially, the last 15 years, I've focused almost entirely on Exhibition on Screen, mm-hmm. for various reasons, not least commercial survival. But the one ongoing project that I've been working on as well is the Afghan project. So when I was finishing Hopper a couple of years ago, which was a big job, I was also finishing the Afghan film, which was a huge job. And it never really finishes. Only today I heard from Mir's niece in Afghanistan. She sent me a WhatsApp message. So we stay in touch with them. And as an aside, when I finished the 20 years project, that for me was it. I thought, that's it, I finished. This is just too much. But frankly, the plight of women there is so awful that Despite myself, I have open conversations with the one broadcaster that supported me, which is a German broadcaster, about whether there's something we can do. So it's not necessarily, the doors aren't completely shut. But it is odd. And in fact, one of the blessings of documentary filmmaking is this ability to kind of go into different subjects in depth for like 1 or 2 years. The downside in a way is that certainly if you're releasing those types of films to the cinema, is that you're always trying to then engage with a different audience. Which takes a lot of time. So it's one thing if you've got a recurrent brand like exhibition on screen, mm-hmm. otherwise it's virtually impossible.
Yeah.
So when broadcasters, you know, have a decreasing commitment to public service, it makes my life virtually impossible as a filmmaker.
I get it. I hear you. Well, and also as a person, you know, if you're doing a mega movie of about Vermeer, which I'm dying to watch, you don't have to have your stomach roiling at 10 p.m. at night about what's going to happen to Vermeer. But if you are deeply connected to somebody with whom you have had a connection for 20 years, who is in a delicate situation, who is at risk, you know, that you do carry with you just as a person, let alone a documentary filmmaker. And I admire that. And I just think it would be super hard, you know, every news broadcast, every civilian bombing, every attack on journalists.
He becomes a, at the end of the film, he has become a cameraman covering those kind of events.
Yeah. I haven't watched it yet, but you, well, we can talk about that, but I did watch an interview you did with a film festival in England somewhere where you had your co-director who had COVID, you know, he was talking, but just that whole thing of it's hard not to cry your way through it when you hear 9 journalists are killed.
Yeah.
And yet he survived.
He was cycling, because the odd thing about Afghanistan now, which is why it's enormously frustrating that this film hasn't been shown in the United States, because people see things in black and white. And, you know, I've sent a copy to people like Kamala Harris, and just so that they're informed. Mm-hmm. Because Afghanistan now should be much more than just whose fault is it that the departure was so messy. Truth is, it was both their faults. Trump did a terrible deal. Biden did a terrible exit. Or people around them. Anyway, but that isn't really the point. The point is that 3,500 Americans were killed. I think Americans sold, was it $2 or $3 trillion spent? So you have to kind of analyze, well, what was achieved and what wasn't achieved? And it's multiple shades of gray. Certain things were achieved, certain things weren't. And in fact, even some of those achievements are bizarrely still there. But anyway, the point I was going to make is the thing to understand about Afghanistan now is that the murderers, the suicide bombers, are now in control. Well, that means for men, life's much better, it's much safer, because there are no suicide bombs. There's occasional ISIS, but it's pretty rare. So there's plenty of Afghans you will meet who'll say life is now better. We're not being bombed by the Americans. We're not being shot by the Brits. We're not being blown up by suicide bombs in cities, at least. But if you're a woman, it's probably the worst country in the world you could live in. So it's you know, it's a very mixed picture. The Taliban, I mean, if they had just accepted, the stupid thing for them is if they'd accepted female rights, then actually quite a lot of people would have come to an accommodation with them, you know. But they simply find that they can't do it. Anyway, Mir and his family have, they've left, they're in the north. They seem to be safe. He's working as a taxi driver. And they've talked about leaving. It's not that easy. They don't have passports, which makes it even harder. But they haven't talked about leaving for a while. Anyway, so then when you go from that to then talking about the work of Johannes Vermeer, it is slightly odd, I admit.
Yeah. And, you know, as a documentary filmmaker, you're supposed to have a certain detachment, a certain objectivity. You're not supposed to intervene in the lives of your subjects, even though Mir himself wanted to become a journalist and wanted to play with cameras and things like that. So that was coming from him. But, oh, my God, you know, I would think that the temptation to say, can I get him out of there, would be great, you know. And
I think it's a complete misnomer, the idea that you observe and don't intervene. As soon as you start filming, you've intervened. I get frustrated with filmmakers who sit on stage and say, you know, I'm just showing you reality. We don't intervene. We can't intervene. You've intervened by putting somebody on screen. So there are then choices about how realistic the portrayal is. And obviously you try to make it as realistic as possible, but you're not going to go to somewhere like that. And just for insurance purposes, you are mandated to have a certain amount of dollars with you. My first trip, I had to have $10,000 with me, which was a pressure because you have to hide it and make sure nobody steals it. You're then dealing with people who are poverty stricken. So you can't just walk away and give them nothing, particularly as they've given you their time and a story that you filmed and all that that means. So then it's really a question of how best to compensate somebody. And that's a whole, which I always talk about. I'm always happy to talk about that on stage. Because those are some of the difficult decisions you have to make. What is the right way of compensating? And then what about, you know, the first time I met him, he was one of 200 families. So what about the families living right next to him that I may have caught on camera? What about all those families? You know, then also from a self-preservation point of view, should you reward the local warlord that's given you permission to film there? Should you do something for the village, the town? Should you do something for the young girls who are already being discriminated against? So all these things you have to decide. You can't just wander in, film and leave, really. Of course, one of the problems today also is that it's so easy to just buy a camera and go to these places. But I mean, you also have to not only be skilled at storytelling, you have to be trained in survival, really. So again, the broadcasters, I think, are being negligent because they won't cover any of that. They won't even commission the film. They'll just have a look at it when it's finished, which encourages people to take risks. But anyway, these are big conversations. I mean, if the broadcast industry was different, I'd be very happy to use my kind of documentary skills in Ukraine, for example. But I'm not going to go to the Ukraine, and you know, it's impossible to go to the Ukraine self-funding again. And you know, I don't know when you last had a insightful revelatory film about Ukraine on American television, but we're not getting them here occasionally. But usually, in fact, the only two we've had have been about Zelensky and about the mayor of Kyiv, you know, and then one about frontline troops. So this really significant war that's going on, we've had three documentaries that I've seen, which is, you know, every week we've got plenty of stuff about half-naked kids on desert, you know, on Caribbean islands, or celebs doing, you know, railway tours. Anyway.
Yeah, well, no, these are all important questions. And, you know, the first one that I really had was, how did you, 20 years ago, how did you get to Afghanistan?
So,
and it wasn't really safe even then, you know, 20 years ago, maybe.
Well, So I've been a documentary filmmaker for 40 years, and I was fortunate. And I you know, all these artists and composers that I've made films about, you can't understand their lives without understanding the time in which they were born, the economic context, what else is happening, technological developments. It's entirely relevant when you look at the life of Mozart or Monet. In my case, there's certain things that happened. In the United Kingdom, when I was growing up, we had three channels. That was it, three television channels. You turned on the television physically, pushed a button to turn it on. You sat down, it was on BBC One. I get our equivalent was PBS. To change channels, you had to get up and push a button on the television set. So sometimes you never did. You just watched BBC all night. And you would watch whatever the BBC was showing you. So it might go from a quiz show to a hard-hitting drama to sports show to, and you might show one soccer match. So there was a real sense of public service broadcasting. There's a real sense of just coming across things. Anyway, 1982, I think it was, we had a fourth channel called Channel 4. And the significant thing about that channel was that it was only to use independent producers, independent production companies. Unlike the BBC and ITV, where you were staff and you worked your way up and there's a lot of politics, took a long time. Why my brother who lives on Vashon is significant is because when I was finishing my schooling, he was in India. And he would send me the most amazing cassette tapes that he'd recorded sitting on some palace wall with a monkey that had just stolen his sandwich, talking about what he could see. So I was determined when I finished my exams that I was going to go to India and visit him. And I did that. And when we arrived, he said, I'm going to take you somewhere that you won't have heard of. It's called McLeod Ganj, Dharamsala. It's in the Himalayan foothills. We got on a bus the next day from Delhi. And the thing about Dharamsala, which is significant, is that it's the home of the Dalai Lama of Tibet and the Tibetan community in exile. I'd had a good education, but I'd never heard of Tibet or the Dalai Lama. So this was completely new to me. Now, I wanted to be a photographer. I'd wanted to be a photographer for some years. But that week or however many days we spent there was eye-opening to me. And also I decided in that moment that I wanted to tell this story, which I found immediately fascinating. But I didn't feel I could do it photographically. I felt I needed sound as well. So that was the moment I changed to wanting to become a filmmaker.
How old were you then?
18.
18. So this was like 40 years ago, we're talking?
Mm-hmm. We are. Well, actually 43 years ago, so I'm 61 now. So we're talking 1982.
I'm speaking with award-winning British documentary film director and producer Phil Grabsky, who will be with us at the Vashon Theatre on October 29th.
So I'm almost 19. Anyway, I then got into film photographic college. And while I was there, I made a film. I went back with my brother to India and Nepal. And long story short, I made a film about the Dalai Lama of Tibet, which I managed to sell to another channel in Britain, one of our then four channels. So I'm age 22, I've become an independent producer, very early independent producer. For the next 15 or odd years, I did a lot of history. And these are films that are still today kind of watched on Amazon, Great Commanders, Ancient Warriors. I did a big series for the BBC, The Rise and Fall of the Roman Empire. So I've made about 200, 250 films, and a lot of them are biographies. And I guess my thing that I've done an awful lot of, so I guess I've become quite skilled at, is doing a lot of research and reading all the correspondence of someone's life and so on, and then distilling that down to an engaging, entertaining, fresh, but accurate and honest biography of someone, whether it's 50 minutes long or later, these 90-minute feature films. So when I did the rise and fall of the Roman Empire, I did it through six individuals. Julius Caesar, and then following him, five emperors. And through these six people, you could tell the whole story of the Roman Empire. And, you know, it's a lot of work. I did a book that went alongside it, Great Commanders. I did a book, and that books take even more work than TV programs.
Yeah, it's available on Amazon. I went, how did you ever do that on top of everything else?
A lot of work. Yeah. But I love doing it. And then we did six history films with Terry Jones from Monty Python, who was a historian as well as a comedian. And we were lucky because at that time, you know, Discovery were commissioning this type of thing. The BBC were commissioning this type of thing. A&E, you know, the A used to stand for arts. In fact, they've now got rid of the name entirely, but it stopped standing for arts a long time ago. So again, I'm fortunate in that I'm in a period when, although it was time consuming, but we could get funding. Mid-1990s, we started doing arts films, quite niche. There weren't many producers doing arts films, but again, I loved it. And it was, we did like a 21-part series on great artists. And again, you're having to distill the life of Manet into 23 minutes, and Renoir and Van Gogh and all these people. And there was an audience for it. Where broadcasters, I think, have got it completely wrong is they keep telling me there's no audience. But every time we make an arts film, we put it out, we get an audience. So I've never understood this.
So when you were in that moment in time, back in the 90s or so, did you have your distribution already worked out in advance? Were you commissioned, or had you gone into this independent producing phase where you were generating it and then, supporting yourself?
The way it worked then was that you would take an idea to a broadcaster, and they were the gatekeepers, and they would say, three-part series on two films on the hidden history of Rome, the hidden history of Egypt with Terry Jones, going to be quite expensive. Okay, we're in. Now, in the case of Discovery, they would fully fund. So you'd have a serious grown-up conversation about how much it's going to cost, and they say, fine, we'll pay for it. Then it started to change a little bit, and they would say, well, we'll put up some of the money. You need to find some of the money from somewhere else. You need to find a distributor. It was time consuming, but basically these things were pre-funded. But then things started to change, and one, filmmakers started to own their own copyright, retain the copyright in their films. So the broadcasters started to think, well, we're not going to pay such a high amount of money if we don't own the films anymore. Broadcasters, there started to be lots and lots of more channels, which meant that broadcasters started getting very competitive. And, you know, if advertising is going to other channels, then they have their budgets start to drop. They start to focus on not public service. You know, they don't really care about public service anymore. There are exceptions, of course, and there's been wonderful, wonderful programs that are made. Speaking generally, individuals within organizations and the organizations themselves start to get more competitive, and it starts to be more kind of celebrity driven, youth orientated. The advertisers want to hit 18 to 28 year olds who haven't yet made their minds up about what type of fridge they want to own or what type of car they're going to buy. You know, more or less at our age, we kind of know we like this type of, you know, television set or serial. So it became, the other thing that happened was, again, because of technology, in some ways the technology helped. That film in Afghanistan, when I started it, I shot that on my own with a very small camera, which was only really introduced 25 years ago. Before that, we've been shooting on big, heavy video cameras, and before that on film, which is expensive. So that's kind of prevents people from making films very easily. Now it's very easy. These types of cameras, no lens on it at the moment, but these types of cameras, they shoot high resolution video.
Yeah, we're
I mean,
looking at what looks like a regular
it's like a regular.
DSLR film.
Sorry, this should be. I haven't got
Yeah.
the lens on, but it's a regular camera. It costs. It's not that cheap. Maybe $6,000. Shoots ultra high resolution, but compared to the $50,000 that a camera might have cost in the past, and of course, there's no film stock, so I can shoot forever on this. And so people started going into doing reality shows in hospitals and in, nightclubs or whatever it is. The trouble is, I mean, it's a good thing and a bad thing. The downside of it is that you have so many people who pick up a camera and then say, well, I'm a documentary filmmaker. They're all flooding the broadcasters with ideas, but they're sitting at home, they're shooting a lot of stuff, and that you can now shoot and edit yourself. So you can direct shoot and edit on the laptop like this, which means you can produce things much more cheaply. So when a broadcaster says, well, we'll take it, but we're only going to pay you $5,000 an hour, then if you're a single person who's you've maxed out on your credit cards, you'll take it. Whereas what the broadcaster should be paying is $50,000 an hour, $100,000 an hour. They should, proper way fees. So basically, the documentary industry, in a sense, is broken because it's very hard for us to generate the correct license fees for the films that we make. So I just had a conversation. I mean, I've been doing it for 40 years and, have a reputation or whatever, but one of my key broadcasters in the United Kingdom, I've managed to sell them one of my Exhibition on Screen films, and their offer to me was zero. We'll show it, but we won't pay you. Now, I have to say, I've had the same offer from PBS. We'll show you some of your art films, but we can't pay you. You can try and sell advertising. You can have the 30 seconds before the film starts. If you can. I haven't got time to sell advertising in the United States.
Oh my gosh.
And, the one in Britain, I don't know how many hundreds of millions pass through PBS, and I know PBS is under threat, but the one in Britain is a £4 billion, $5 billion, $6 billion almost a year organization that was going to show one art film, mine, but couldn't afford to pay me. And I challenged this, and they said, well, we're just not, it's just not a priority. Now, it's not only art films that are suffering, it's also, social documentaries. Because what they're trying to do is make films that get 5 million people, and they don't really value the films that might only get 1 million people watching, but actually will have an impact. So, come the end of the 1990s, I could see the way the wind was blowing, and this
And let me
new.
just take a footnote. Had you shot the first episode with Mir, where he
No,
was?
that's exactly what I'm about to say. So,
Okay, great. Thank you.
I could see the way the wind was blowing. I could see that you could now shoot on these cameras. I was frustrated with television. And my wife and I sat down and basically we decided that I should just decide on a subject I wanted to make and just go and shoot it. And this was just about the time when the Taliban fell, were kicked out in 2001. Actually, it was even a little bit before that. It was when the Buddhas of Bamiyan were actually blown up in March 2001. This wanton act of vandalism, stroke terrorism by the Taliban. And then everyone's talking about the Taliban and Afghanistan. Post 9/11, I mean, it's true that Osama bin Laden had based himself in Afghanistan, so there weren't any Afghans on those planes. But still, I understand that there was a desire to hit back, and Afghanistan got hit really quickly. As a result of which, the Taliban were kicked out. The same Taliban that had just been in Washington, by the way. Anyway, and I thought, I don't believe that all Afghans are terrorists and all Afghan men are terrorists and all Afghan women are mutes behind their blue burqas. So I decided to go and find out for myself. So that meant flying to going via Islamabad into Afghanistan. And you asked right at the beginning about how dangerous it was. Well, I wasn't really sure what the reception would be. I'm not aware of a filmmaker before me, post-Taliban. So there weren't any real reports coming out. Certainly under the Taliban, you ran the risk of being arrested. If you were, you wouldn't get into film when the Taliban were in power. But actually, so I was a little nervous, but I went down to the main, I had a very good Afghan fixer. Anyway, I went down to the main marketplace in Kabul and just got my camera out. I wasn't really filming, I just got my camera out. And it was fine. So I kind of was relaxed. And so actually, the main issue for that in that first trip was mines. The Russians had basically dropped millions of mines from helicopters all over Afghanistan. And, everywhere you went, there were stones by the side of the road, which were red on one side and white on the other. White meant it was safe, red meant that there are mines there. And again, one of the things that has happened over the last 20 years is that people on their hands and knees have been basically just working through field after field, demining the country successfully. Unfortunately, even within a couple of years, the Taliban had come back. And but also you had kidnapping just, as soon as somebody's kidnapped and a ransom is paid, then that becomes very attractive. So it's general crime, Taliban return. So it did become nerve-wracking. But where I was filming was up north, where that was relatively safe. Towards the end of the film, when the action moves to Kabul, that became more challenging. But I had a very good, I co-directed this film. I met somebody after 2 years, an Afghan director, and he was fantastic. We're still very good friends. And so there's certain situations where he filmed and I didn't, and that worked very well.
Can I just interject? Because you initially, if I understand right, you were thinking you'd capture the story of an Afghan man. Or
yeah.
I don't know whether you were thinking about a woman, but you ended up going for a boy.
Yeah.
Why was that?
So I didn't know what the story would be. I hadn't thought about children. I just assumed it would be about a man. I assumed that a woman wouldn't let me film her. Actually, older women were vocal, but only behind the scenes, not out in the open. So it would have been very difficult. I did think at one time about bringing out a female friend of mine who's a director. The men that I met on that first trip were, again, willing to talk, but they were talking about the past, which isn't really a story. It's good background, and it features in the first film that they talk about life under the Taliban, during the Civil War, under the Russians. Powerful stuff, but and we have to understand the history. While I've had 40 years of filmmaking, they've had 40 years of war. But it was a few days into my time in Bamiyan where I first met Mir, a couple of days before I first met Mir, but a few days before I realized that he would be the story. And the advantage of a child, particularly one as engaging and funny and adventurous as him, is that one, day to day, you don't know what's going to happen. Every day was different with him. He was constantly getting up to different scrapes. But two, it also projects the story forwards, which I wanted to do, because you're looking at a child and thinking, well, what's his world going to be, rather than what has their world been? No, I had absolutely no plan of following him for 20 years. I mean, who thinks like that? But that the first film was just following him for a year. And then deciding, actually, that's not enough time to see how a country changes. So then it was 10 years. And I didn't really intend to go beyond that. But then this German broadcaster said, you've got to carry on. And then we did it for another 10 years, which was actually very difficult. But I'm glad we did. And it's a shame, you know, we won the BAFTA for this film. So my friend Shuaib is the first Afghan to win a BAFTA, but he has to keep it quiet. He can't tell anybody in Afghanistan because it might put him at some kind of risk.
Because the movie can't be shown in Afghanistan, is that right? Or
I don't even know if they have an open, I doubt they got cinema there. And right now there's no there's no Afghan TV channel that would show it. So not really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I've also heard you say that your 20 years is enough. And at the same time, your heart is still open to Mir and his family and the situation in Afghanistan.
Yeah, so it was very difficult finishing the film for just production reasons. What really was dispiriting was the difficulty in getting funding. Even though we'd made two films about this boy and they'd done very well and they'd won awards, and it's such a clear narrative. It's so easy for broadcasters because they can see this boy growing up. Afghanistan is still at the time, you know, I'm trying to raise funds in 2012, 2013, when broadcasters I'm talking to are in countries where we have soldiers fighting and dying, where we're all spending hundreds of millions of dollars. I thought it'd be a slam dunk. I thought it would be really straightforward to get a Sundance or an HBO or a BBC or an NHK. But they were just disinterested. Partly because their attention had turned to Iraq, but partly because they just, don't know. I was really disheartened by it. We kept going. You know, if it wasn't for my wife, who runs the financial side of the company, just finding money here, there, and everywhere. Shuaib doing a lot on the promise of being paid at some point. Once we'd finished it, it got shown in just about every country in the world, except the United States, where broadcasters said, yeah, well, our audience don't really want to watch films about Afghanistan. And I just think that's dreadful. I think that when people now sit and have a conversation about what was achieved in Afghanistan, or the departure from Afghanistan, or indeed what's happening in Ukraine, or in Israel / Gaza, Lebanon, there are lessons to be learned from Afghanistan, which if you don't watch programs like this about the people involved, you're never going to learn. Anyway, I finished the film and figured that, you know, we did very well. I guess the pinnacle was winning the BAFTA, and that was going to be it. But, you know, I would say that it's the worst country in the world to be a woman right now. They can't sing, they can barely talk, they can't be seen, they can't travel without a man. And they'd had their hopes elevated. You know, for some of that period over the last 20 years when the Taliban weren't in power, there were women in most roles, and they were being educated, and there were judges and TV presenters and skiers and cyclists, and, you know, now you can't, as a woman, you can't do any of that. And it's not even that you're sitting at home thinking, I can't do any of those things. You are being sold off to be married. I mean, it's just dreadful what's happening. Mm-hmm. So part of me has reopened, you know, opened up the door to thinking that whether there is some kind of continuation of the story which somehow can continue to bring, well, not so much Mir's story, but just refocus it on what's happening to women, or maybe doing that specifically through the women in his orbit. We'll see. Wow. I have to have a conversation about this with the one broadcaster that supported me, who's a German broadcaster, I had to talk to them at the end of the month. So,
yeah. I mean, this is so interesting on so many levels, you know, the whole story about making the story, but also, you know, what's happening to us in our attention span, where our understanding of Gaza and Ukraine and formerly Afghanistan is social media going by a mile a minute. And, you know, one bombing one day and then the next day you're onto something else, and it doesn't stick, and it's all really difficult to take, and you feel rather impotent in dealing with it or understanding it. But the rapidity of these things goes against our ability to sit with a situation that requires depth and understanding and history. And that's hard. It's hard to make it work commercially, but it's also hard to get our attention spans.
No, I totally agree. And people become very polarized. Israel was attacked, has every right to go after Hezbollah and Hamas in this way because of the heinous crimes of October the 7th, 2023. But things aren't quite that simple. The thing that I could saw in Afghanistan straight away was that this is a long-term project, but you had a population that were on your side. You weren't going to change this in 1 year or 2 years. And then, of course, when Iraq happened and everyone's attention, some really important people went to Iraq, the money went to Iraq, you know, the arc light of attention went to Iraq, and Afghanistan was kind of at a time when Afghanistan was there, and 99% of the population were really pleased that there was no more war. So you need to be informed. Now, television still really remains such a power to inform people. I mean, we all listen to podcasts and maybe read the papers or certainly check social media. But actually, to get a real understanding of a situation, a really good documentary can really help. Because we're all kind of sentient, sensitive human beings, but often our actual knowledge is pretty superficial.
I'll break here for now before we begin another conversation about Phil's major project, Exhibition Screen. I invite you to come and see the documentary, My Childhood, My Country, 20 Years in Afghanistan, when it shows at the Vashon Theater on October 29th, to be followed by a conversation and Q&A with Phil talking about the film and the film industry. And find out more about Phil at 7thart.com. or on the show notes for Embracing the Muse. Thanks so much for listening. I look forward to being back soon and bringing you another conversation with an island creative who can show you how it's possible to embrace your muse and live your richest and most creative life. Till then, thanks for joining us, and thanks to Voice of Vashon, 101.9 FM, for hosting this show. I'm your host, Sally Fox, and I look forward to being with you soon.